The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Hello, I'm Jason Solomons, and this is Film Weekly. This week, we're honoured to have one of the UK's finest film producers as our guest. Yes, Jeremy Thomas has produced such works as The Naked Lunch, Sexy Beast, and The Last Emperor, to name really just three. Ahead of this week's celebration of his work at the Curzon here in London, I'll be finding out why movies are in his very soul. And Anglo-French actor Marina Hans gives the performance of the week in An Ordinary Execution. I talk to her about her role in this beautiful story of love and fear under Stalin. Guardian critic Peter Bradshaw is my guest reviewer, looking at releases this week that include George Clooney in The American, Denzel Washington, Trainspotting in Unstoppable, and a Mexican with a huge sword in Robert Rodriguez's Machete. Cut it and it bleeds cinema. It's Film Weekly. Jeremy Thomas was born into British cinema. Both his father Ralph Thomas and his uncle Gerald Thomas were very established directors in the UK, working on the Doctor films and the Carry Ons of the 1960s and 70s. Jeremy surely picked up a business mind from his family's work in cinema, but his own career is as much marked out by artistic ambition as it is by box office success. Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor won Jeremy a Best Picture Oscar, one of nine for the film at the 1988 Oscars. However, all his pictures, from Cronenberg's Crash and The Naked Lunch to Oshima's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, Jonathan Glazer's Sexy Beast, Stephen Frears' The Hit, all seem to have as little artistic compromise as possible. I suppose it's for that reason, and for many more, that the Academy itself are decamping to London this Thursday to honour Jeremy's career. But I'm delighted to say that before that, Jeremy joins me in the Film Weekly studios to allow me to pay my own minor tribute to his career. Welcome to Film Weekly, Jeremy, and congratulations, I suppose, are in order. The American Academy, are giving you this tribute. Why?
Well, I was incredibly happy when they asked me and all told me, you know, would you take this tribute? And I was surprised because it's the American Academy, but they cinema, I suppose, is the American thing in a way more than Britain, and they recognise those 55 movies, although they're not sort of mainstream movies. But American Academy. And because I've been sort of honoured by them with an Oscar before for one of my movies, I suppose. It's
sort of, yeah, you're sort of part of the family. But it does go to show, because, I mean, you've always stayed here in Britain and made your movies from Britain, which, as we know, even as we speak, it becomes a harder and harder task. Next Monday, the government's going to lay out the kind of future of film. You've managed to kind of go through the highs and lows of British film, and yet America is the one sort of that kind of sees you as a global, I suppose, filmmaker. How do you see yourself? Because you were born into British film.
West London, I'm a West London boy, born in Ealing, within the site of Ealing Studios, where my dad was working. And then I grew up near Pinewood later on. And I love London, you know. I enjoy the streets of London, and I don't want to swap them. I mean, I love America also, land of cinema. Principal land of cinema, our bigger brother.
Yeah.
But I managed to sort of sustain my work living here and thinking about film as a global communication.
Yes, but I mean, because you've worked with, you know, Italian directors in Bertolucci, Canadian directors in Cronenberg, Japanese directors in Oshima, Takashi Miike. You've worked with, Stephen Frears from here, Jonathan Glazer from here. London has been, you know, being able to kind of house those projects here whilst traveling abroad. You know, you haven't needed to go to Hollywood. Was there any moment that you went, right, I've got
to? Well, I've been there. I went there. I did a film for MGM, directed by Nicholas Rowe, called Eureka, starring Gene Hackman. My first and last experience of a studio movie, which was nearly closed down whilst we were filming in Jamaica. So I made one film in Hollywood, although I'm grazing Hollywood, of course, for talent.
So you made that one film, but what, you just thought, no, that's enough?
I'm truly an independent sort of guy, you know, and I work well under my own pressure, and I don't work well under other people's pressure. As a child also, I mean, it's my personality, and I would luckily recognize that, and so I didn't want any more of those horrible battles and stomach churning, blood on the carpet type of thing.
It's odd that I always thought that you're a producer, because the producer is the person who kind of has to kind of, you know, assuage the artistic ambition of a director and kind of, you know, bring that onto budget and kind of be on time and make sure everyone else is on time. And yet here you are, this very laid-back man who kind of likes to be independent and work on his own pace. I would have thought you were more temperamentally suited to directing 55 films than producing them.
Well, in my head, I directed them all as well. But no, I've directed my only film. I directed one film. But I love, you know, I love the artists that I work with. And when I talk to my colleagues, they all are talking about their sort of disdain or difficulty with artists, actors, directors. And I love them, you know. And I've only had, I think I've got one Bette Noir who's an actor who should be nameless. And the rest of the hundreds and hundreds of that I've worked with, and all the directors and all the talent that I work with seem to be my brethren.
Yeah. You're such a red rag to a journalist, Jeremy. You're the one person that you don't like, and you're not going to tell us who he is.
I can't.
This isn't the time for a
memoir. It'll be in the memoir. I'm keeping it for the memoir.
You clearly enjoy hanging out with the artists and the artistic side of it, and all your films seem to have that kind of ambition in there, an artistic ambition, and never really compromising on that. And also, you've actually managed to have commercial success as well. Is that something you learned when you're at the knees of your father and your uncle, when you were in what was a factory? You mentioned Ealing and Pinewood at the time, and they were really churning out the kind of the quotas.
My father and my uncle were contract directors, and they were there to churn out hits. And they made a lot of hits, I have to say. They made about 100 films between them. And they were incredibly successful films.
These are the Carry-Ons.
Uncle made the Carry-On films. My father made the Doctor films and many movies, 13 films with Dirk Bogarde and all the sort of the Grand Glamour School. And he just churned out these hit after hit. They were very, very successful. And I suppose maybe this is some sort of reaction, because when I left school, I got into the film business through the laboratory union card. It was very unionized, the business. And then I think my second or third job as a sort of a paid job was working for Ken Loach. Mm-hmm. So there was this sort of middle-class boy from sort of home counties who was, brought up in a sort of fairly conservative background. And there I was working with Ken Loach with that group, and my eyes were opened, and I have to say that Ken was maybe one of my, my father was a teacher, but my next teacher about things in life was Ken.
On a cinematic scale, a political scale as well?
It was a completely foreign territory for me, and my eyes were opened to many things by Ken. Certainly the sort of different sort of filmmaking to my dad and my uncle and what I'd been watching, because I was on the film set all the time. And I saw something very different.
On this program, people want to be actors, people want to be directors. Do enough people go into the business here wanting to be producers? Do they know what producers even do all day?
Well, unfortunately, producers are not really an admired breed. And even when I started in the business, it was a cliche of a producer would be a sort of vulgarian with a cigar barking. And no mobile phone in those days, but they were barking at people. And I suppose there are still a lot of people like that, because a producer equals a certain amount of business.
Yes.
And business is tough. But to me, the film business is literature and photography and acting and design and music. All the things that I love outside of the movie business. Mm. It's all encompassed in the movie business. Plus business, which I also like.
I mean, we talk about America, we talk about here. Mm. You actually sort of based a lot of your career in Europe as well. I mean, you take up residence in Cannes every 2 weeks. They've been very kind to you at the Cannes Film Festival. In France, they respect you. I know that sounds like that's some kind of sort of backhanded compliment, because they like Jerry Lewis too. But, I mean, they do like you in France.
I mean, it's not the Academy tribute that's happening. I mean, I was, I was thrilled that it was the American Academy, and I am much more recognized maybe in other countries than I am in the UK. But I view the world as a cinema, because the film can travel easily all over the world. Either it used to be in 6 cans, now it's in a little signal going down the internet. So it travels very easily. Cinema
has that Does that change your job? Has that changed your approach to cinema? The way that you used to be able to go to, you know, The Last Emperor, you can film in Japan, in China, you can take a big crew. I mean, I presume you could probably do that anymore. Or you don't need to do that.
I don't think you could. Well, a lot of things are done digitally now. So I'm a realist about that. And when I see Social Network and I see at the end of the credits shot on Red, which is, for everybody, that's a modern digital camera, and you see the quality of that, and I was amazed, and I thought, well, wow, this is the film's been shot like that, and I thought it was shot in the old way, which still I'm enjoy when I hear one of my directors say to me, I really want to shoot it on a Panaflex in with a celluloid. I know it may be a bit more expensive, and then I think, but there's a special thing to a film camera that when a film goes through the camera, everybody concentrates, because on a video camera, the film just, the video just, or the signal just flows through, and it doesn't really matter about, are you ready for the take? Okay, with an action. Everybody ready? Sound running, picture running, action. Everybody's very, very focused on that moment. And
you are an old romantic in a way, Jeremy. I mean, it sounds to me that were through the magazine of the film is really where the action is for you, that moment that you described.
I remember on the film I did with Tony Curtis, put his hand out to the camera. There's a film directed by Nick Rogue called Insignificance, and he put his hand on the camera, and he felt the camera. I said, what are you doing that for, Tony? He said, it loves me, baby. And sort of, you know, there's a relationship, this the living beast, this camera with the film running through, which occasionally blocks and everything else.
Now, the Academy are going to be here, and they're going to kind of, you know, they I suppose they decamp a certain sort of branch of the Academy, comes to London, and they kind of bark around, and they kind of, you know, they'll I suppose they'll give a three-line whip. They'll summon up some of the great people you've worked with. I know Stephen Frears is going to be down there, with whom you did The Hit, which is a wonderful, wonderful film. Keira Knightley, with whom you're working at the moment, is that right? And Michael Fassbender.
I think Keira and Michael are coming. We've just finished a film with them, directed by David Cronenberg. Shot on film, because David and his cinematographer, Peter Schutzitsky, they love film still. I'm sure they'll be moving to digital soon, like all of us will.
Yeah, but I mean, all of these people will be there, and you'll have your sort of, in some kind of way, your career sort of assembled out in front.
I'm looking forward to it again and dreading it in a certain way.
Do you know what they'll be sort of highlighting? Are there sort of films
They'll be showing, it's something that they're doing, so I don't really know exactly, but they've been choosing clips of some of the films that they like. And then people who were involved with those films will be talking about them.
Do you like them all?
I mean, I'm up to 55 movies, which is, when I look at Dino De Laurentiis, who passed last week, and he produced over 200 films.
Yeah, so you better get a move on.
I'd like to make the century of films. You know, I'd like to make it to the 100, but I don't know what the people are going to be saying, and I hope it's sort of light, not too embarrassing.
I hope they unearth some skeletons as well in your cupboard.
There are a lot of them. I think Ken Loach might be coming in. I know that he's always telling stories about how I made a very, very bad, or dropped his bacon sandwiches and got the HB sauce mixed up with the ketchup. And
that didn't let that bleeding kestrel fly off with his with his bacon sandwich. Oh, blimey, we'll never get it again. Cost him a fortune. Jeremy, whenever I go to your office, I'm amazed by the posters on the walls. I forget. I walk up those stairs and I think, oh my God, he made all of these films. They're all amazing. They're all among my favourites. So it's an absolute pleasure to have you on Film Weekly on such an occasion as well, when you're honoured by the American Academy. I'm sure there are many honours to come. And listen, if you want to make 100 that century, we'll be backing you all the way. And hope, please God, Film Weekly is around.
I've got to get moving.
Yes, but before that, enjoy Thursday night celebration of your great career. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jason.
And now another legend of the big screen joins us for the week's releases, Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Oh,
thank you for that.
How lovely to have you. Yeah, follow that, Jeremy Thomas.
Yeah, lovely to be here. Yes, indeed. Thank you.
We're going to look at The American. We're going to look at Unstoppable. And we shall look at Machete as well. But we should also examine Landon Boulevard as well.
Marvellous.
Let's start with The American, which stars George Clooney as a sort of assassin come gun maker, signing his last trip. He goes to Italy. Here he is discussing his final job with Matilda, played by Thelke Reuten. However, they may not be alone.
The weapon must be fairly light and compact.
How compact?
As compact as possible.
Want an automatic rifle to fit inside a woman's purse?
A small vanity case would be permissible.
A small briefcase would be possible. Noise?
Silencer.
I can only give you a suppressor. It'll dampen the decibels and dislocate the sound source.
Reduce the muzzle flash. Can't make you silent, but I can make you invisible as long as you're willing to lose some range. 2 o'clock. Light blue shirt, sunglasses. Is he with you?
I didn't see him. In any case, I'm alone.
George Clooney there, strong and silent type this time.
Yes, very strong and very silent, very much so. I think the film is... I feel that it was very intelligent and beautifully photographed and the tiniest bit dull. Am I allowed to say that without being struck down by a thunderbolt? I really liked it in many ways, but I felt that it was sort of exasperating as well.
But I mean, it could be a bit dull because it is done by the Dutch filmmaker Anton Corbijn, who did such a good job with Control.
Oh, he did a brilliant job with Control.
But his before that, much of his pop photography is very moody, kind of lots of black and white, kind of indie bands standing against kind of urban backdrops, or indeed murky skies.
Yeah.
He's all about the mood.
He's all about the mood. I sense that despite that, or perhaps because of it, The film was a little stymied because of his brilliant eye for a still shot, a still composition, a still tableau. He was always setting up these brilliant sort of almost quasi Edward Hopper shots of George Clooney, and he had two separate sets of sunglasses that are looking just absolutely spiffy in his various gear. I mean, he looked as if he was doing a shoot, frankly.
The thing is, he's supposed to be this kind of anonymous American.
I've never seen anybody more obtrusive. And his... frankly, I mean, likeable, but really quite preposterous liaison, this Mathilde, who had a different hairstyle for each of her scenes with him.
Yes.
Presumably for subterfuge purposes, and yet nothing could be more ostentatious.
Different dress as well, cashmere dress.
I mean, if I was anywhere near them, I would be standing around open-mouthed at these spectacular kind of exquisites. Apparently, I would be looking around, where are the photographers? You know, surely they're doing a fashion shoot. This is ridiculous.
There is also, he does sort of dally with a local as well, local
He does indeed. Again, this tiny and what seems to be a rather austere Italian town seems to be supporting a kind of Vegas level brothel.
I put this red lights, this
spectacular kind of bedroom with the kind of erotic kind of decal over the bed. Again, I haven't got a problem with it. I enjoyed it.
We don't see mainstream films have sex scenes like that in it. I mean,
no.
There's literally kind of, you know,
there is a pretty full on sex scene. Yeah. A pretty full on sex scene with what I understand is known as a sexual act going forth. It's the kind of thing that.
Is it lewd?
Generally speaking, the MPAA doesn't like sex scenes, violence.
Not with both feet off the ground.
No,
anyway.
Exactly. Yes, this is a very much both feet off the ground thing. I thought it was exquisitely photographed and very intelligent. And I'm, in a way, thrilled to see it there because it was such a high IQ film. I suspect that Anton Corbijn, in the most laudable and interesting way, is trying to establish a kind of auteurist technique which exists entirely independently of Control, which looked a little bit like his black and white sort of NME material.
Yeah.
And he was trying to establish something which exists independently of all that. And that's what he's done. Certainly a very, very distinctive looking movie. It looks a bit like an advert for BMW some of the time, to be honest, especially those overhead shots. Of the winding roads. It did look very classy.
It did
and
look
luxury.
Classy. The film also does kind of. I mean, it's written by Rowan Joffe. Actually, yes. I note whose Brighton Rock as directorial debut will come out soon. And
yes.
It's a film which I also seen, which deals very much with sin and redemption. Yes. And there's a sort of religious kind of aspect,
yes.
And there's a profane aspect as well. There's sex and religion.
It is
in them.
What I think is interesting. It came across more with me when I watched it the second time. Is what Rowan Joffe, I think, very intelligently has brought in a kind of Greenian aspect to the film. I've described it as Frederick Forsyth with a dash of Graham Greene, which I think more or less nails it. But yes, he's somebody who, without doing anything so unsophisticated as believing in God or anything, yearns to be judged and to be punished in order to be relieved of this terrible guilt, a generalized sense of guilt, and a very specific guilt, which is disclosed in the excellent opening scene, which I think this the opening scene I think is terrifically
it's
good.
It's a big shot,
and
it's a huge thing.
It's absolutely brilliant,
iconographically as well.
And it leads you to sort of hope for something sort of more kind of dynamic and action packed in a way.
Yeah. Should we up the pace a little bit and go to Unstoppable? Because here's Denzel Washington telling us just very precisely how things are going to turn out on the tracks.
Check your timetable, and it's going to tell you the siding's 4,111 feet, but that's signal to signal. In reality, it's more like 2,500 feet. You add those five cars that you picked up.
And we can fit.
No, we won't fit. Dispatcher, 1206. Can you tell me where the nearest rip track is?
1206, there's one in 6.2
I could listen to Denzel Washington read out the phone book because I think he sounds great. And essentially, really, he does little more than that in this film on Stockholm. about a runaway train.
I just thought that this was a film which I just couldn't be doing with it. It is just ridiculous. I just didn't believe it. It was based on a true story.
It's based on a true story, Peter.
Everything about it, I thought, looked as phony as a $4 bill, to be honest with you. I just didn't buy everything about it.
But, I mean, it's quite simple. There's a train that they haven't...
I don't want to give it away, but yes, the idea is this train is speeding away. Their job is to whiz up behind it in that fantastic sort of Thomas the Tank Engine way, couple on, ram on the brakes and bring it to a spark-showering deceleration in time for Denzel Washington to literally to scamper, get up on a moving train and walk over the roofs of the carriages. Now, I haven't seen that done for real without, not tongue-in-cheek, but implying that it can be done for just years.
It happens all the time.
I suppose it must happen all
the
time.
My son watches the programme called Chuggington. Which is
Chuggington, yes.
It's brilliant. And this really was that. It was that.
Don't get me started on the factual inaccuracies in Chuggington. a talking train, thank you.
This might as well. They just get kind of shunting into sideways, going to pick stuff up.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, the odd thing about Tony Scott is that, I mean, you know, For all we, you know, critics can sort of say, well, you make rubbish films. He makes loads of them.
He makes loads of them, and by golly, he punches them out. Well, the one thing I thought was sort of brilliant but funny is that his sympathies as a director are clearly with the train. It just was so ridiculous.
Is there not something, nevertheless, very cinematic, kinetic, very kind of... In fact, what are we going to the cinema for? It reminds me of the train leaving La Ciotta Station, the Lumiere Brothers' first film.
Yeah.
Trains have always been big in the cinema. Buster Keaton's The General, through to any Westerns, which just reminds you of people climbing
on trains. I agree with that. But what I want to say about that is that so often it doesn't stay rigorously with the train. You're cutting back to people watching it on TV.
Yeah.
It's all about Fox News covering it on TV. You're given these scenes in sports bars and front rooms of them shouting and screaming and cheering and hollering, which is clearly what the audience is supposed to do. We're supposed to take our cue from that. And it's exasperating because it's in the end, it's kind of not very cinematic. It's about you're watching television at second
hand.
People
watching telly, yeah. Although The Social Network, people say you're just watching people watching computers doing that as well.
Well, yes, that's true. But I found it. I mean, you're talking, not quite comparing like with like. But
I'm not. Unstoppable. You know, actually, I was like, go a bit, sort of go in the end. I thought, God, I wouldn't. I sort of enjoyed my bucks in a way, although I didn't pay anything.
I mean, I have to sound like such. I feel like such a grumpy old Eeyore about this film.
You're allowed to be.
That's me all over.
Yeah, no, it's
I wanted to
nonsense.
Love it. The first 5 minutes and 10 minutes, I kind of was into it, but then it just ran on rails.
He doesn't do much in Denzel either. No. They're sort of in that cabin and they don't do much.
I love the idea of Chris Pine being a conductor as well. I thought, is he going to have to go through and go, tickets, please, come on now. But no.
Maybe he'll do that on the next episode of Star Trek.
Yes.
He's the conductor for the SS Enterprise. Shall we move to Machete as well, which is Robert Rodriguez, Danny Trejo, a man with a very big handlebar moustache. He's been wounded, but luckily the lovely Luz, played by the gorgeous Michelle Rodriguez, is on hand to nurse him.
Try not to bleed on the bed.
Are you... she?
Unfortunately, she's a myth. Just someone I made up.
You're a fighter.
Only when there's something worth fighting for.
Is there?
Always. When the sun rises, you should be good. Cuidado. Don't start what you can't finish. Machete.
You know me?
I know the legend.
Maybe the legend's better.
I'll be the judge of that.
And nursing back to health, she does. His machete is proud after this scene. Peter, this is, I suppose, this is the last installment, another installment of the Grindhouse trash masterpieces that Rodriguez and Tarantino turn out.
I'm not sure about that. I've been hearing off and on rumours that Edgar Wright is going to make Don't, which was another of the spoof trailers.
That was the one in the trailers.
Yeah.
Yes, he made it.
And I'm hearing rumours that he might get that off the ground.
Would you tell him to do so? Would you say do?
I don't. I'm not sure, really. I I've seen Machete twice now. I mean, it's got a lot of brass balls to it, and it's got some outrageous gags, outrageous things in it. It sort of unwinds, and it becomes, I think, it overstays its welcome by a good 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's technically, it's socked over, as they say in Variety. It is socked over with terrific power, and you could do an awful lot worse on a Friday night than go and see Machete.
Machete or Unstoppable? Machete or Unstoppable?
Oh, Machete. Loads more than Unstoppable.
Peter, we must, before we go, talk of London Boulevard.
In it.
Yeah. There are times when a gangster is something to be.
And when is that? You're not going to come and work for me, that's obvious. You really think I'm going to let you walk free around this planet? It ain't going to happen.
See, what you have to understand is that if I was a gangster, Rob, you'd be the first to die. Huh? I wouldn't work for you. I'd kill you and take everything you've got. Huh? If I were a gangster.
Colin Farrell's just out of Pentonville.
Yeah.
Gets assigned to look after the beautiful European film star played by Keira Knightley in her posh Holland Park mansion.
Yes.
Why?
What fascinates me about this is it's written by William Monahan, who is a Bostonian guy. He seems to have been, he must have been coached or learned at some Burlett school how to speak in Cockney and how to do the dialogue. He's probably a very big fan of classic kind of London gangster movies of a certain vintage, because in a way it did resemble older.
We're talking Blow Up, we're talking Performance here.
Yeah, I would say because of the interest in West London posh, bit rough and a touch of class in it, you know, and the Plassey Bird having a bit of a tondresse for the rough hewn guy with a rough diamond sort of bloke, who, like, in a way, in the manner of the young Michael Caine, scrubs up very nicely and put him in a whistle and flute, and he looks absolutely the business. And he does. Colin Farrell looks very nice in what presumably is an off-the-peg suit. We didn't see him go to the tailor, but he does look very nice. Again, it's like a lot of films. It degenerates into a slightly sort of Nick Love-ish, Guy Ritchie-ish revenge montage at the end.
And yet you've got Ray Winston in there as well, doing have the lemon salt.
Again, it's almost a kind of constitutional must. Who else could do it? Nobody. Yeah.
But then there's also a scene where him and Colin Farrell face off, going, "I didn't say that. You did say that. I did say that." Doing the round shoe thing from Sexy Beast.
Yeah, but that, if you compare it to Sexy Beast, had 1,000 times more menace and subtlety and genuine kind of class. Whereas I think London Boulevard, as I say, I'd love to talk to William Bonahan and say, who's kind of coached you and how to do this? Especially the scene where the Scouser goes, "Yeah, calm down."
Stephen Graham, the great Stephen Graham, who sort of knows it.
He must have improvised that scene.
Because they've got an American director who hasn't got a clue what I'm doing.
He won't understand the levels of irony, and he just...
I thought of the limey at several points this, with that split screen thing. I mean, all of these like the name itself, it doesn't exist, and none of these characters exist.
Yes, exactly.
There was no real...
There is a kind of American touristy kind of take on everything.
Yeah, I did think it was geographically correct. I mean, they go to the Criterion Brasserie for dinner and they step out into Piccadilly Circus.
Yes, that's true. And what a miracle that is, that he, as it were, can step onto the Caledonian Road without turning left and ending up in outside Holland Park Tube Station.
There is someone, David Thewlis is quite good.
David Thewlis, yes. It's the perennial question is, what do we do? We should have to commission some royal commission or prime ministerial office of what we should do now with David Thewlis. You know, maybe we can get Mr. Cameron to chair some important committee and say, how do we employ David Thewlis into it? Because he is good, and you give him a chance. He's got that outrageously funny, if very bad, taste line about Monica Bellucci in the film. I don't think that we can even say he's a terribly good turn in this. He's a terribly good turn in the Harry Potter.
In the Harry Potter's Mr. Nice.
Where is he? Where's he gone? Where's he going? He's very good. Maybe he cannot be asked. Maybe he just can't be asked. But he's one of these people you just think, if somebody, some lo-fi film was to put him right at the top of the billing, he could be great again.
I mean, Gangster Number One makes me think of it again. I mean, a loss, but he's still around.
But I think he's one of these people that he needs somebody to write him a script.
Let's do it right here and now.
I think we need to call up, well, not me.
Let's call time on the Film Weekly Review section and off we go to write Mr. Thewlis a script.
I can't think of anything more worthwhile.
Peter Bradshaw, thank you very much indeed. To read all of Peter Bradshaw's reviews, all you've got to do is pick up a copy of The Guardian or go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film.
Sais-tu pourquoi tu es là?
Non, maître.
Je ne suis le maître de personne, juste camarade. Camarade Staline.
An Ordinary Execution tells of Anna, played by Marina Hans, a doctor and a healer who's forced to treat the sickly Joseph Stalin during the winter of 1952, amid an atmosphere of fear, random disappearances and executions. Marc Dugain's film explores the tyranny of a dictator, but also examines his human side. While Stalin himself is superbly brought to life by veteran actor André Dussolier, one of the most notable aspects of the film is the central performance by a young actress, Marina Hans, who won a César for her Lady Chatterley in 2007 and now adds another terrific performance to an already impressive catalogue of work. And I'm delighted to say that Marina Hans joins me on the line from Paris now to tell me more about An Ordinary Execution, or in French, Une Exécution Ordinaire. I do like a French film that has the same title in French and in English. That's too often they muck them up, don't they, Marina?
Oh, yes, they do. Always.
But it's lovely to have you on the show. I mean, you speak beautiful English and fantastic French as well. We've seen you much more in French theatre and movies, not in English stuff. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, I trained in Lambda in London, though, for a year and got an agent when I was just starting. But I got some more work in France, actually.
Yeah, and so you've never really looked back. You've been working in France ever since, really.
Yes, and I just did a play last year in Theatre Clwyd in Wales, which was Mary Stuart.
Oh, right, a good role.
Yes.
Yeah, excellent.
And I could have a little French accent, and that wasn't a problem.
So, I mean, do you consider yourself French or English?
Well, Welsh. I'm both, really, but I was born in France, and you know, I went to school there, so my English is sort of sounds okay because I have half of my family in England, but my vocabulary is better in French. Yeah, sometimes, especially at the moment, you know, I kind of like being English more than French, but that's, you know, politically. I really love at the moment saying that I'm half English, you know.
it gives you sort of best of both, or worst of both worlds, or best of both worlds, depending on.
Well, it depends, but it's just better anyway, you know, to have half.
Yes, absolutely. Why not? And I mean, I mentioned nationality because it's quite interesting, because I think people going to see An Ordinary Execution would be expecting a French film, which of course it is. But yes. Then it's set in Russia. In fact, there was a gentleman in the screening I was at, and he came in and everyone was speaking French, and then Joseph Stalin appears, and I think he went, oh, well, hang on, this is in Russia, because if you miss the beginning, you don't know that it's in Moscow 1952. So
no,
I think he was a bit confused there.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, at some point, Marc Dugain, the director who'd written the novel, he thought that maybe we should do it in English, because in English, you're very much used to, you know, everybody anywhere speaks English, and it's not a problem, like in Schindler's List, or you know, or even Marie Antoinette, you know. And in France, the fact that we were, you know, speaking French in Russia was sort of weird, very weird for people here to sort of take on. And it was a challenge for us because we were thinking, okay, now we're telling a story and maybe it's going to be weird for like the 10 first minutes. And then it opens, you know, other gates as well to imagine things more than to be in sort of a historical thing, very precise, and that's it, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in Hollywood, they sometimes give the Russian the bad accent like this.
I know, that's
so could you do that in French? No, you didn't do that. But everyone were parler comme ça. I don't know how they would do with a French bad accent.
I don't know, but they wouldn't allow that in France, I think.
No, it would have been awful. So I'm very glad that you settled down, because as you say, it does settle down. And I thought it was lovely for an English audience to watch a sort of French kind of people doing Russia. And I think it worked beautifully. And I think the performances of the three of you, yourself, Marina Hans, Edouard Barr, who plays your husband, Bayer,
yes,
And, of course, André Du Sollier, who plays Joseph Stalin. I mean, it took me about a while to kind of go, is that really André Du Sollier? He looks just, and it's not even that much makeup. He just inhabits the role. So I think you're all brilliant in it, actually. I mean, it's a film that took me completely by surprise. In a way, it's one of those films I don't want to say too much about because we don't really know what's going to happen. It unfolds as a mystery. We know, first of all, your character, Anna, we don't really know what sort of doctor she is. And then suddenly you see her doing her magic, if you like. And it comes very as a surprise. Was that the idea of the film, to let the story kind of unfold so the audience didn't really know what to expect?
Well, yes, I think there was an atmosphere that had to be, you know, very clear at the beginning, that there was fear everywhere. Mm. But if we started, you know, telling the things, you know, in a very sort of precise way, then, you know, it wouldn't connect. We had to connect in a period that we can't even imagine. So if you say too much, then it's just you start going intellectually into the story, which wasn't what we were trying to do. We were trying to, you know, capture the essence of this man, this cruel man. I mean, really, sort of, how can you describe someone like that? And trying to go into these human behaviors that have no heart, no soul, nothing.
Yeah,
and then at some point connect with the history of it.
Yeah,
know?
Absolutely.
But to feel it before you start to think about it.
So let's just be clear. Is this a true story or it's not? I mean, a lot of what we see is true. Stalin watched John Wayne movies. He listened to Mozart. We know that. But the actual story of you, this doctor who goes to actually kind of look after him, that's a fiction. Although he did have personal physicians.
Yes, and he had, I think it was a very famous pianist that he used to wake up in the night to have and have her sort of play for him whenever he wanted. So there was that sense of, you know, having whatever he wants at any time, and that really existed, of course.
Where did you shoot it, Marina? Because it looks, I mean, the atmosphere is great. I mean, it has that feel just right, but I'm sure you didn't go to
Moscow. We shot in Romania.
Oh, Romania, very good.
A part of it, and then a part of it was in a studio in France.
Because the atmosphere, I mean, that was very key to get that kind of, like, just that right sort of feeling. And it's not too cliched either. I think they do that just right, all three of you. So it was an excellent film. It completely took me by surprise, I have to say. Did it do well in France? Is it a success?
Yes, it did well. People were surprised as well, because it was sort of, it was very challenging, you know. And also, André Du Sollier is a big star here, and he's very well known, and he does, you know, loads of films. So people know his voice, his looks, and everything.
Right, so it was a big thing, his Du Sollier doing Stalin, let's go see that sort of thing. Like Helen Mirren doing
really
the Queen.
Yeah, they were surprised by his work in a very good way. And the makeup as well is very often, you know, difficult.
Yeah, poor you. You hardly got to wear any makeup.
No.
You're the girl here. You hardly had anything on.
No. No, well, I don't think she was a coquette.
No, she wasn't really. Rather like your Lady Chatterley, who, of course, was a fantastic performance as well.
Well, that was very different.
Yeah, she didn't have much on either, to be honest with you, but that was more clothes. where are we going to see Marina Hans next? Because I think it's a terrific performance. I did love you, obviously, Lady Chatterley as well, but I thought this one was really lovely to see another side of you, if you like.
A very strong...
But she was beautiful and reserved and dignified and all of those things, and compromised as well. And I felt very emotional for her. So that's an excellent performance for you.
Thank you.
Where are we going to see more of Marina Hans?
Well, I don't know what's going to go in, you know, to travel in England. I know I have a film coming out in France probably in January or February, I'm not sure, by Claude Miller.
Oh, right. Excellent director.
So that's the next one.
What's that called? So we can look out for that.
That's called Voyez comme ils dansent, see how they dance, or somehow.
Well, I like the title already.
Yes,
that can translate into English without
them
mucking
like
it up.
It's about two women sharing the same man, and who's an artist, obviously very tormented artist, and they, after he dies, they sort of meet and have a whole relationship.
Who's the actress you're sharing him with?
It's an Italian actress called Maya Sansa.
Ooh.
And the man is James Thierry. I don't know if you heard about him. He's well, he's Charlie Chaplin's grandson, and he came in London with his show. He does theatre a lot, but he does his own creation. It's a mixture of dancing, circus, and all that. He's brilliant, brilliant actor.
Well, this sounds absolutely fascinating. But for now, we shall content ourselves with watching une exécution ordinaire, or an ordinary execution. And then hopefully everyone will get to know you well here, Marina, and you'll be equally successful on this side of the channel. But for now, thank you very much for joining us from Paris.
Thank you very
Merci
much.
Beaucoup, thank Marina Hans-Tahl, very much.
Thank you.
An Ordinary Execution is on limited release here on the UK from Friday, the 26th of November. One of the surprises of the week. Brilliant performances, lovely film. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is from the kinetic score to Unstoppable by Harry Gregson-Williams, a Hollywood regular there. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for the best film news and reviews, including my tips for the Oscar season and my trailer trash column, of course. Do join us again, but for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, until next week, it's goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.